Section 4. Supplementary Remarks. Since the development of the productivity of labour proceeds very disproportionately in the various lines of industry, and not only disproportionately in degree, but frequently also in opposite directions, it follows that the mass of average profit equals the surplus value must be substantially below the level one would naturally expect after the development of the productiveness in the most advanced branches of industry. The fact that the development of the productivity in different lines of industry proceeds at substantially different rates, and frequently even in opposite directions, is not due merely to the anarchy of competition and the peculiarity of the bourgeois mode of production. Productivity of labour is also bound up with natural conditions, which frequently become less productive as productivity grows, inasmuch as the latter depends on social conditions. Hence the opposite movements in these different spheres, progress here and retrogression there. Consider the mere influence of the seasons, for instance, on which the bulk of raw materials depends for its mass, the exhaustion of forest lands, coal and iron mines, etc. While the circulating part of constant capital, such as raw materials, etc., continually increases its mass in proportion to the productivity of labour, this is not the case with fixed capital, such as buildings, machinery, and lighting and heating facilities, etc. Although in absolute terms a machine becomes dearer with the growth of its bodily mass, it becomes relatively cheaper. If 5 labourers produce 10 times as much of a commodity as before, this does not increase the outlay for fixed capital tenfold. Although the value of this part of constant capital increases with the development of the productiveness, it does not by any means increase in the same proportion. We have frequently pointed out the difference in the ratio of constant to variable capital as expressed in the fall of the rate of profit, and the difference in the same ratio as expressed in relation to the individual commodity and its price with the development of the productivity of labour. The value of a commodity is determined by the total labour time of past and living labour incorporated in it. The increase in labour productivity consists precisely in that the share of living labour is reduced, while that of past labour is increased, but in such a way that the total quantity of labour incorporated in that commodity declines. In such a way, therefore, that living labour decreases more than past labour increases. The past labour contained in the value of a commodity, the constant part of capital, consists partly of the wear and tear of fixed, partly of circulating, constant capital entirely consumed by that commodity, such as raw and auxiliary materials. The portion of value deriving from raw and auxiliary materials must decrease with the increased productivity of labour, because with regard to these materials, the productivity expresses itself precisely by reducing their value. On the other hand, it is most characteristic of rising labour productivity that the fixed part of constant capital is strongly augmented, and with it that portion of its value which is transferred by wear and tear to the commodities. For a new method of production to represent a real increase in productivity, it must transfer a smaller additional portion of the value of fixed capital to each unit of the commodity in wear and tear than the portion of value deducted from it through the saving in living labour. In short, it must reduce the value of the commodity. It must obviously do so, even if, as it occurs in some cases, an additional value goes into the value of the commodity for more or dearer raw or auxiliary materials over and above the additional portion for wear and tear of the fixed capital. All additions to the value must be more than offset by the reduction in value resulting from the decrease in living labour. This reduction of the total quantity of labour going into a commodity seems, accordingly, to be the essential criterion of increased productivity of labour, no matter under what social conditions production is carried on. Productivity of labour, indeed, would always be measured by this standard in a society in which producers regulate their production according to a preconceived plan, or even under simple commodity production. But how does the matter stand under capitalist production? Suppose a certain line of capitalist industry produces a normal unit of its commodity under the following conditions. The wear and tear of fixed capital amounts to half a shilling per piece. Raw and auxiliary materials go into it to the amount of 17.5 shillings per piece. Wages, 2 shillings, and surplus value, 2 shillings, at a rate of surplus value of 100%. Total value equals 22 shillings. We assume, for the sake of simplicity, that the capital in this line of production has the average composition of social capital, so that the price of production of the commodity is identical with its value, and the profit of the capitalist with the created surplus value. Then the cost price of the commodity equals 1/2 plus 17.5 plus 2 equals 20 shillings. The average rate of profit, 2 over 20 equals 10%, and the price of production per piece of the commodity, like its value, 22 shillings. Suppose a machine is invented which reduces by half the living labour required per piece of the commodity, but trebles that portion of its value accounted for by the wear and tear of the fixed capital. In that case, the calculation is wear and tear equals 1.5 shillings, raw and auxiliary materials, as before, 17.5 shillings, wages 1 shilling, surplus value 1 shilling, total 21 shillings. The commodity then falls 1 shilling in value. The new machine has certainly increased the productivity of labour, but the capitalist sees the matter as follows. His cost price is now 1.5 shillings for wear, 17.5 shillings for raw and auxiliary materials, 1 shilling for wages, total 20 shillings as before. Since the rate of profit is not immediately altered by the new machine, he will receive 10% over his cost price, that is, 2 shillings. The price of production, then, remains unaltered, 22 shillings, but is 1 shilling above the value. For a society producing under capitalist conditions, the commodity has not cheapened. The new machine is no improvement for it. The capitalist is therefore not interested in introducing it. And since its introduction would make his present, not as yet worn-out machinery, simply worthless, would turn it into scrap iron, hence would cause a positive loss, he takes good care not to commit this, what is for him, a utopian mistake. The law of increased productivity of labour is not, therefore, absolutely valid for capital. So far as capital is concerned, productiveness does not increase through a saving in living labour in general, but only through a saving in the paid portion of living labour, as compared to labour expended in the past, as we have already indicated in passing in Volume 1, Chapter 15. Here the capitalist mode of production is beset with another contradiction. Its historical mission is unconstrained development in geometrical progression of the productivity of human labour. It goes back on its mission whenever, as here, it checks the development of productivity. It thus demonstrates again that it is becoming senile and that it is more and more outlived. Under competition, the increasing minimum of capital required with the increase in productivity for the successful operation of an independent industrial establishment assumes the following aspect. As soon as the new, more expensive equipment has become universally established, smaller capitals are henceforth excluded from this industry. Smaller capitals can carry on independently in the various spheres of industry only in the infancy of mechanical inventions. Very large undertakings, such as railways, on the other hand, which have an unusually high proportion of constant capital, do not yield the average rate of profit, but only a portion of it, only an interest. Otherwise, the general rate of profit would have fallen still lower. But this offers direct employment to large concentrations of capital in the form of stocks. Growth of capital, hence accumulation of capital, does not imply a fall in the rate of profit, unless it is accompanied by the aforementioned changes in the proportion of the organic constituents of capital. Now it so happens that in spite of the constant daily revolutions in the mode of production, now this and now that larger or smaller portion of the total, capital continues to accumulate for certain periods on the basis of a given average proportion of those constituents, so that there is no organic change with its growth, and consequently no cause for a fall in the rate of profit. This constant expansion of capital, hence also an expansion of production, on the basis of the old method of production which goes quietly on while new methods are already being introduced at its side, is another reason why the rate of profit does not decline as much as the total capital of society grows. The increase in the absolute number of labourers does not occur in all branches of production, and not uniformly in all, in spite of the relative decrease of variable capital laid out in wages. In agriculture, the decrease of the element of living labour may be absolute. At any rate, it is but a requirement of the capitalist mode of production that the number of wage workers should increase absolutely, in spite of its relative decrease. Labour power becomes redundant for it, as soon as it is no longer necessary to employ it for 12 to 15 hours daily. A development of productive forces which would diminish the absolute number of labourers, that is, enable the entire nation to accomplish its total production in a shorter time span, would cause a revolution, because it would put the bulk of the population out of the running. This is another manifestation of the specific barrier of capitalist production, showing also that capitalist production is by no means an absolute form for the development of the productive forces and for the creation of wealth, but rather that at a certain point it comes into collision with this development. This collision appears partly in periodical crises, which arise from the circumstance that now this and now that portion of the labouring population becomes redundant under its old mode of employment. The limit of capitalist production is the excess time of the labourers. The absolute spare time gained by society does not concern it. The development of productivity concerns it only in so far as it increases the surplus labour time of the working class, not because it decreases the labour time for material production in general. It moves thus in a contradiction. We have seen that the growing accumulation of capital implies its growing concentration. Thus grows the power of capital, the alienation of the conditions of social production personified in the capitalist from the real producers. Capital comes more and more to the fore as a social power whose agent is the capitalist. This social power no longer stands in any possible relation to that which the labour of a single individual can create. It becomes an alienated, independent social power, which stands opposed to society as an object, and as an object that is the capitalist's source of power. The contradiction between the general social power into which capital develops, on the one hand, and the private power of the individual capitalist over these social conditions of production, on the other, becomes ever more irreconcilable, and yet contains the solution of the problem, because it implies at the same time the transformation of the conditions of production into general, common, social conditions. This transformation stems from the development of the productive forces under capitalist production, and from the ways and means by which this development takes place. No capitalist ever voluntarily introduces a new method of production, no matter how much more productive it may be, and how much it may increase the rate of surplus value, so long as it reduces the rate of profit. Yet every such new method of production cheapens the commodities. Hence, the capitalist sells them originally above their prices of production, or perhaps above their value. He pockets the difference between their costs of production and the market prices of the same commodities produced at higher costs of production. He can do this because the average labour time required socially for the production of these latter commodities is higher than the labour time required for the new methods of production. His method of production stands above the social average. But competition makes it general, and subject to the general law. There follows a fall in the rate of profit, perhaps first in this sphere of production, and eventually it achieves a balance with the rest, which is, therefore, wholly independent of the will of the capitalist. It is still to be added to this point that this same law also governs those spheres of production whose product passes neither directly nor indirectly into the consumption of the labourers, or into the conditions under which their necessities are produced. It applies, therefore, also to those spheres of production in which there is no cheapening of commodities to increase the relative surplus value or cheapen labour power. At any rate, a cheapening of constant capital in all these lines may increase the rate of profit, with the exploitation of labour remaining the same. As soon as the new production method begins to spread, and thereby to furnish tangible proof that these commodities can actually be produced more cheaply, the capitalists working with the old methods of production must sell their product below its full price of production, because the value of this commodity has fallen, and because the labour time required by them to produce it is greater than the social average. In one word, and this appears as an effect of competition, these capitalists must also introduce the new method of production, in which the proportion of variable to constant capital has been reduced. All the circumstances which lead to the use of machinery, cheapening the price of a commodity produced by it, come down, in the last analysis, to a reduction of the quantity of labour absorbed by a single piece of the commodity, and secondly, to a reduction in the wear-and-tear portion of the machinery whose value goes into a single piece of the commodity. The less rapid wear of the machinery, the more the commodities over which it is distributed, and the more living labour it replaces before its term of reproduction arrives. In both cases, the quantity and value of the fixed constant capital increase in relation to the variable. Quote, all other things being equal, the power of a nation to save from its profits varies with the rate of profits. Is great when they are high, less when low. But as the rate of profits declines, all other things do not remain equal. A low rate of profits is ordinarily accompanied by a rapid rate of accumulation, relatively to the numbers of the people, as in England. A high rate of profit by a slower rate of accumulation, relatively to the numbers of the people. Examples, Poland, Russia, India, etc. Unquote. Richard Jones, An Introductory Lecture on Political Economy, London, 1833. Jones emphasizes correctly that in spite of the falling rate of profit, the inducements and faculties to accumulate are augmented. First, on account of the growing relative overpopulation. Second, because the growing productivity of labour is accompanied by an increase in the mass of use values represented by the same exchange value, hence in the material elements of capital. Third, because the branches of production become more varied. Fourth, due to the development of the credit system, the stock companies, etc., and the resultant case of converting money into capital without becoming an industrial capitalist. Fifth, because the wants and the greed for wealth increase. And sixth, because the mass of investments in fixed capital grows, etc. Three cardinal facts of capitalist production. 1. Concentration of means of production in few hands, whereby they cease to appear as the property of the immediate labourers and turn into social production capacities, even if initially they are the private property of capitalists. These are the trustees of bourgeois society, but they pocket all the proceeds of this trusteeship. 2. Organization of labor itself into social labor, through cooperation, division of labor, and the uniting of labor with the natural sciences. In these two senses, the capitalist mode of production abolishes private property and private labor, even though in contradictory forms. 3. Creation of the world market. The stupendous productivity developing under the capitalist mode of production relative to population and the increase, if not in the same proportion of capital values, not just of their material substance, which grow much more rapidly than the population, contradict the basis, which constantly narrows in relation to the expanding wealth and for which all this immense productiveness works. They also contradict the conditions under which this swelling capital augments its value. Hence, the crises.